I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
From the Society for Nautical Research, in partnership with Lloyd's Register Foundation, I'm Sam Willis, and this is the Mariner's Mirror podcast, the world's number one podcast dedicated to all of maritime history.
Hello. Today I'm very excited to welcome Dr. Nina Baker and Dr. Anthony Firth. Nina is an independent researcher looking at the history of women in engineering. She is currently working on a project on women shipbuilders on the River Clyde in Glasgow. Anthony is an archaeologist specialising in marine, coastal and inland waters, and is the head of marine heritage strategy at Historic England. He is currently working on a project on women shipbuilders on the River Tyne. They are here today to tell us a bit more about their Clyde and Tyne explorations and how these projects relate to one another. Welcome, Anthony and Nina. To start off, could you both tell us a bit about who you are and how you both came to work on maritime history?
My name is Nina Baker. A long time ago, 50 years ago, I was a merchant navy deck officer in oil tankers and cargo ships. And since then, I've done all sorts of other things, mainly in the engineering field, although I'm not an actual practicing engineer. I got interested in the history of women in engineering-related work, and I've been doing that as an independent researcher for the last 20 years. And I got involved with the Lloyd's Register Foundation when they were looking for people with an interest in maritime-related women.
Brilliant. So you have a practical and academic perspective on this. Anthony?
Yeah, so I'm a marine archaeologist by background. I've been involved in marine archaeology throughout my career. Now I work for Historic England as their head of marine heritage strategy.
Wow, brilliant. So you are both currently working on projects surrounding women in shipbuilding on the River Tyne and the River Clyde, respectively. So if we start up in Glasgow and then work our way down, Nina, could you tell us a bit about women shipbuilders on the Clyde?
Well, it's hard to know when women were first doing work in shipbuilding on the Clyde because working class women's stories are rarely recorded. Shipbuilding on the Clyde didn't really get going until the 18th century, when the Clyde was made deep enough for seagoing ships to come up to the Clyde from the coast. It started first at Port Glasgow and Greenock, and then was all the way up the Clyde. There were loads and loads of shipyards. In 1906, there was a big step change because Yarrows moved their shipyard from the Isle of Dogs on the Thames up to the Clyde, and a lot of other shipbuilding followed that. And in the 1890s and early part of the 20th century, 75% of all shipping in the world was built on the Clyde.
Oh, wow.
We know that women, there were certain sorts of work that women always had done, things like French polishing of furniture and panelling. And from the 1860s, they'd also worked in ancillary trades like rope making. But in actual shipbuilding, the First World War is when we first know about them doing that kind of work, because they were brought in as the men were sent away to war. And there are very few named women. There's a photograph of some named women from a Port Glasgow shipyard, and it's possible that one of those women also went on to be someone who was photographed as being a leader of a group of welding women in the Second World War. A woman called Agnes Smith may have been Agnes Russell, working in an engine shop in the First World War. After the end of the First World War, and indeed this happened again at the Second World War, the law required all women who had been taken on for war work to be dismissed so that the men could have their jobs back. The yards didn't have any choice in the matter. They had to dismiss the women. Very tiny numbers of women were able to stay on, but they were like ones and twos. In the Second World War, there were a lot of women working in both the civilian and naval shipyards, and they were doing all sorts of things, welding, fitting, electrical work. There is still a very, very elderly lady in Glasgow called Janet Harvey, who was one of only four women to train as ship's electricians on the Clyde in the Second World War. She's now over 100, still very sparky, but living in care. We know about her, and she's told some of her stories about how the work was easy, but the men were hard.
That's fascinating. And how are you finding this information? What sources are you having to go through?
Well, it's the usual thing. Imaginative search terms in Google, looking in the newspapers. Lots of other people have done work about the history of the shipyards, and you know, sometimes they've unearthed bits and bobs. So it's a question of knitting it all together, really.
Yeah, brilliant. And this woman that you spoke about, who is over 100, have you been and interviewed her and talked with her about those experiences in person?
Yeah, not formally, but yes, I have. And in fact, when I first heard about her a few years ago, I was so taken with her story, and she's just such a lovely lady, that I tried to get an honour for her in the honours list, but you can only get national honours for work you're doing at the moment. But I was able to arrange through the Glasgow Caledonian University for her to get an honorary doctorate. And she got loads and loads of media coverage. She was on the BBC. They interviewed her. And it was lovely because, you know, she was a working class East End Glasgow girl, no qualifications. And she, after the war, she worked in retail all her working life, never married. So for her, the very end, last years of her life, to be recognised in this way and to become, you know, Dr. Janet Harvey was a real kick for her. She just loved it. And she's a super person. I don't know if anybody's done a formal oral history interview, and maybe I should see if that's still possible. But she has spoken in public about her experiences.
That's really fantastic. And how do these women initially get involved in shipbuilding? What's the kind of process?
Well, it's hard to know, but in the Second World War, we know that the Ministry of Labour actually advertised for women to go into the shipyards nationally. They produced a little booklet and so on about what the work might consist of. And if you were of an age and situation to be doing war work at all, the Labour Exchange would send you to where you were needed. You might have a bit of choice, and certainly if you lived in a shipbuilding area and you probably knew people in shipbuilding, probably male family members either were or had been in shipbuilding, or neighbours certainly would have been, you would know where there might be a well-paid job that you fancied, and you'd just go and talk to the foreman and say, you know, I'd like to do this work. But probably a lot of women were sent by the Labour Exchange. You had a choice if you were of conscription age. You either went into munitions work or you went into the armed forces.
Wow. So actually, perhaps some of the women that worked on the Clyde were not from that area.
They might not have been. Yeah. It's very difficult to know. We very rarely know any names. Perhaps slightly more in the Second World War than the First, but not much. Working class women, as I say, their names are rarely recorded. They rarely get into the newspapers, even if they're doing something unusual like being a woman in a shipyard. And we only know about Agnes Smith because the Imperial War Museum did a series of photos of her with her workers, and she was in the newspapers about that time.
Ah, okay. I see. Well, it's fantastic what you're doing, and we're hearing all of these stories now, so it's never too late. Right, let's travel on down to the Tyne. Anthony, could you tell us a bit about women's roles in shipbuilding on the Tyne?
Yeah, so certainly. We're interested in a particular set of women who are photographed in shipbuilding roles on the Tyne and also on the Tees in the First World War. So it's quite a narrow focus that we have, and we know very little other than what's shown in the photographs. So that's we're really focusing on that, and we want to discover more about these women. Their identities, their role in the community, what community and family stories there might be about them. So we're starting from a different direction, if you like. We're taking one set of evidence, which is this collection of photographs held by the Imperial War Museums, and see where we can take that information.
Oh, brilliant. And who took the photographs? Do you know who took them and why they were taken?
So most of them were taken by a photographer for a sort of a predecessor of the Imperial War Museum. He's called Horace Nichols. He was a photographer before the war and had effectively a commission to take photographs relating to different aspects of the war and its impact on the home front. So so these photographs went straight to in effect into the official archives, and which is where they've stayed, and they're fabulous photographs, and showing women almost as portraits of them in their daily work, and that's our starting point. We want to discover more about them.
Brilliant. Where do you go from there? How do you use these photographs to then go on to find out about them?
So the photographs have quite limited captions, but they do refer to the yards that the at least some of them refer to the yards where the women were working. So from that information, and we know roughly when the photographs were taken, we can understand partly about the yards themselves, the kinds of work that were going on, but also we can start to think about the ships that these women were involved in building, and then we're working closely with Lloyd's Register Foundation. They have tremendous records of technical drawings and correspondence relating to these ships. So we can start to see where these yards and the women working there fit into the construction of ships. And then we can go on to the histories of the ships that themselves, what happened to those ships as they started on their many journeys around the world. Now, some of them were sunk. So we can find, what we're hoping we can do is make connections between shipwrecks on the seabed and the women who made them. So we have these connections from photographs through to the places where they were built, and which are really important to those communities and associated with those places, but also to the ships where they lie on the seabed in various places around the world. And we're really hoping we can build those connections, if the industrial heritage of these women still lying on the seabed.
Wow, that's really exciting. I've heard there's going to be a pop-up exhibition on the subject in October. Could you tell us a bit more about that and how our listeners can get involved and go and see it?
Yeah, that's right. So our plan is in October to have a pop-up exhibition in Wall's End on Tyneside, actually quite close to the yards where some of these photographs were taken. We'll um, the information about that exhibition will be made available online, particularly through Lloyd's Register Foundation. And there'll be details there, including email addresses to get in touch with us. And what we'll be looking for is, yes, really any family histories or community histories or references, not just to these women, but to the women who were also working in the shipyards alongside them. And yeah, we'll be looking out on the lookout for stories, for photographs, for any kind of anecdotes, even things like the women all wear uniforms. So it would be fantastic to be, you know, if there's any elements of these uniforms still surviving, or perhaps the war work badges that some of the women can be seen wearing. So they used to have almost like little brooches which showed that they were involved in war work, that they could they wore as part of their uniform, but probably wore out of their uniforms too, so that they could show that what contribution they were making. So anything to do with that, either the intangible or tangible aspects of these women's work in the shipyards, would be really interested to find out.
Wow, that would be amazing. Perhaps like Nina, you could find a Dr. Janet, a survivor, who could tell you some more about it.
Yes, I doubt we'll find survivors actually, but we do hope that we might find some stories that are perhaps one or two generations removed.
Yeah, passed down.
Yeah, so passed down stories. We're got high expectations. We think we very much hope that we can add to the story of these women who are photographed but not named.
Definitely. Well, they've got to be out there. Someone's got to know. So a question for both of you. Why do you think that women's roles have so far been largely overlooked in maritime industries?
Well, I think it comes back to the fact that I'm going to say that the middle of the 20th century, it was virtually impossible for women to reach the professional levels in maritime related work. There were a tiny number that were doing work, but usually on the sort of research side, not in the shipyards. And Victoria Drummond, who was the first female ship's engineer, she did her training in the Caledon shipyard in Dundee, and we know about that. And later on, when she was a chief engineer, she supervised the building of ships at Burnt Island later on. But, you know, she was a very unusual example. And it's really not until pretty much the 1970s that women could get the kind of engineering education that might lead them into professional roles. And working class women never get their stories told.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, so the old phrase, you can't be what you haven't seen. So to show that, you know, it's not just yesterday that women have been working in shipyards, means that those women who think they're interested in shipbuilding or naval architecture don't necessarily have to feel that they have to be pioneers as well. We can show that there is a history behind them.
Yeah. Anthony, do you have anything to add, or is that kind of summarising your thoughts as well?
Yes, but there's a really close relationship between the Women's Engineering Society, which is an organisation today, still, you know, working really hard to encourage women into engineering, to support women in engineering. And that organisation has its roots in this period immediately after the First World War, when so many women were frustrated by effectively being pushed out of those roles that they'd developed. And so this is we're working closely with Women's Engineering Society on this. There is as Nina's just said, we want to show that there is a history to women in engineering and in precision engineering, in heavy engineering, in skilled work in the shipyards, which runs through the Women's Engineering Society to today, and really provide that an indication of that heritage, to rediscover stories which have been lost, they've subsided. And we're making what we can of the evidence that we have to draw attention back to that. And hopefully that will act as an inspiration going forward.
Brilliant. So following on from that, why do you think that this work and highlighting the role of women in shipbuilding is particularly important now?
Well, to be fair, there's very little shipbuilding happening in Britain for historic reasons. You know, shipbuilding migrates around the world following the cheapest labour. Yeah. But at the skilled end, at the sort of design end, and at the very high tech end, naval shipbuilding, it's still an important thing. I mean, it's really important in Glasgow's context when it was made known that BAE Systems at on the Clyde had got a big contract for warships for quite a few years to come. That was a huge deal, particularly for poor areas like Govan and Scotstoun, historic shipbuilding areas, because it meant that for the first time, the company could take on really significant numbers of apprentices. And those apprentices could not only expect to see out their time without being made redundant, but could expect work for the foreseeable future. And that's quite unusual in shipbuilding in Britain nowadays. So it's I don't know why Lloyd's Register particularly chose to do this at this time, but it is a great opportunity for women and men to learn more about the opportunities in shipbuilding today.
And as Anthony said, hopefully we can inspire other women to get involved in maritime industries, even if it's not shipbuilding in particular, but just generally to show that history that we have been involved for centuries, but it just hasn't been recorded. But hopefully that's coming out now. Anthony says, is there anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think that point that across the maritime sector, there's an awful lot happening in the maritime sector in a range, whether it's the engineering side, the technology, there's an awful lot happening in the maritime sector. So it's not unusual to see shipyards being repurposed into construction sites for offshore wind, for example. So there's still tremendous need for basically everybody's skills. And we have to be involving everyone to make the most of the challenges that we're facing. You know, so there's, if we can provide indicate the longevity of that, indicate that these are, there is a heritage to this, then we should be using that as a springboard to face all the challenges that we have today.
Perfect. Thanks so much. I think we'll finish on that hopeful and optimistic note. And thank you to Nina and Anthony for your wonderful stories and insights into this fascinating topic. And follow us on social media to hear more about that upcoming exhibition, which sounds really exciting. Thanks for listening, everyone. Be sure to check out our YouTube channel and follow us on social media to keep updated. More news on that exciting exhibition coming soon. I'll be back shortly with some more guests to discuss all things women in maritime history. But goodbye for now.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both as twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.